Conference is being recorded.
Okay. I think it should be fine as long as you guys recognize that I'm typing or writing, so I would not be talking as much. So.
Okay. Yeah, that was my experience too.
You want the synthesizer then to summarize?
Maybe. Yeah, that would be. I think that just to make sure that we're all on the same page. I think that would be.
And then you know, I think to maybe. I don't know if the minutes have to necessarily be as detailed as they have been in terms of who said what at what. You know what I mean?
Right.
Quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would help a lot if it doesn't have to be Aisha said and then, you know, Niradu said and then. Do you know what I mean?
So yeah. Have the content without necessarily. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Okay.
This is Bob. I've got a question. So have you guys circulated minutes of the conference call to each other?
Yes.
I don't, in my folder for your guys' stuff, I don't seem to have those. So I'm thinking I haven't been sent them, and that's just helpful, I think, to Andy and I, so we can go back and...
I can send you those. I have both sets, so I'll send those to you.
That'd be great. Joan Garfield asked us to report to her from time to time, so it helps us knowledgeable if we actually have those with us. Thank you, guys.
Like, for instance, I'm not going to write down that we talked about, right?
I think we'll be okay. So why don't we go ahead and get started then? We each read some articles together. I mean, you know, on our own, and then each of us we have the summaries of the articles we didn't read. And so do we want to do what we did last time, which is each person just briefly present the article that they themselves read alone? How did that work out last week?
This is Aisha. Okay. I guess you guys can probably figure out my accent by now. I personally felt that, you know, when I read through the summaries last time and this time also, that I got a clear gist of what was going on in the articles.
Yes.
And I was just wondering if, because it took up so much time last time, I was just wondering if it might be a better use of our time to, I don't know, use it more for brainstorming than for reporting out. Do you know what I mean? That's just my personal, because I just feel like the entire hour is eaten up, you know, talking about good stuff, but not necessarily moving forward.
Okay.
I agree.
I agree, too.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Okay.
I mean, we've all read it. It's not like we're in school, right?
Yeah.
So, okay. So I was thinking when I was thinking about the call today, I was thinking it might be interesting if each of us, if we just kind of went around and talked about, you know, we had talked about how we were going to come up with some sort of definition for statistical literacy. So maybe, you know, pulling ideas from the different articles, you know, and talking about what each of us came up with. How does that sound?
Great.
Yeah,
okay.
I had a similar thought just looking at what are some characteristics of each of those, the literacy, reasoning, and thinking, so we can kind of come up with what is it exactly.
Right. Do you want to start off here, Astro?
I would love to.
Okay, great.
But Andy? Oh, somebody, I keep hearing this beep.
Yeah, I think I heard it too. I don't know if somebody left the call or... entered the call, but go ahead.
When I was looking at, obviously there's a lot of overlap in the three terms, so it becomes kind of very difficult to kind of distinguish them. But when I was, some things that I, as I was reading, that I thought went more with statistical literacy were talking more about the language of it, like what do the terms mean and what do the symbols mean, and also about the tools that you use in statistics and being able to evaluate and communicate using that language.
Right.
And then for reasoning, it seemed to be more about making sense of the information. So how do the concepts connect? How do the ideas, how do you combine those ideas to make sense of what you're reading? And also being able to explain the process of doing statistics and what did the results tell you. And for the thinking, it seemed more to do with the underlying, what is the theoretical underlying, you know.
Constructs?
The theoretical basis for the features that we do, and what are their limitations, and what are the strengths and kind of constraints of each one of those. So you, it's more to do with why you would use a particular approach over another one. Kind of how I, well, as I was reading, those are the things that distinguish the three to me. But that's more like in talking about them, but in actually doing or teaching to them, it seems like, you know, you could be teaching one thing and getting at all three of them or two of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, which is, I guess, a good thing that you don't have to teach a particular one, because one lesson or one activity could fit as the different ones. And I think in Bob's article, he talks about that.
Yeah, that's who, you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I'm having some trouble hearing, so I just wasn't sure if you were. Did anyone have any comments on what she just said? Well, I did. Is everyone here still?
Yeah.
Not quite. Okay.
Yes.
Hard to tell. Too bad we're not teleconferencing. But anyway. I noticed the same thing with the breakdown. Each of the articles was breaking down the three different parts, thinking versus reasoning, et cetera. But and I think that has to do with measurement. You have to sort of make things a little discrete. But yeah, when I'm teaching, all three are combined. But I noticed in most of the articles were emphasizing context, and that's something I'm noticing with. We just switched to a new textbook where. In the textbook, they're emphasizing the context of the problem as part of the process of solving it, and then and the individual steps as well. In terms of a definition for statistical reasoning, is I like the one that we have, it's just on the first page of the summary that Joan Garfield said that defining it as the way people reason with the statistical ideas and then make sense of it, of the information. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I liked how they had the Venn diagram, and I believe it was Garfield and was it Benzvi article?
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
had the Venn diagram of the statistical reasoning, thinking, and literacy, and they showed that, there's certainly that overlap in the middle, and to use the statistical literacy as the foundation. And then, as like Nirazi was saying, you build up from there. You do the reasoning and thinking. And it was interesting when I was reading that, because I was thinking reasoning, in my mind, reasoning would have been a higher level than thinking. But then in looking at the definitions presented there, I completely understood, okay, thinking is getting to the core theories behind everything. And, boy, that's such a higher level than... I don't know if we expect that in an intro level. The other thing that really jumped out at me was, after reading the articles, thinking, how many statistics courses would we have to teach to be able to even delve into half of the things that we'd love to?
Mm-hmm.
And I also, I don't know if you are feeling the same way. This is, my teaching versus not being a researcher in the past. I'm having, I really find that, I don't know if I have to put two hats on, and those of you that have done research can help me with this, but I feel myself getting distracted in the articles saying, oh, this is a great idea. I need to bring this into my class, and, oh, I do that, and maybe I can change it a little bit. And then I'll say, well, wait a minute, that's not what I'm supposed to be looking at. I'm supposed to be looking at what we're going to research. And I don't know if you found it the same.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I get sidetracked in that, because you can separate. You do want to come up with a topic, but at the same time you learn something new and you feel like, oh, maybe I should apply that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Great stuff.
Yes.
Can I throw in a couple things right here?
Yes.
Okay. One thought is that I think we still don't know just how much we can get students to understand, do, and think and reason statistically within one within a one-term course.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so just to throw that out, that I don't, that's not necessarily what you should research, but just to say, I think that's a question that's out there that's not answered. Just
mm-hmm.
how far can you really take people given where they start from? And then what was the last thing you were just talking about? I just lost it.
Educator versus researcher, maybe?
Oh, you know, I think it's very difficult to separate yourself from teacher and researcher.
Mm-hmm.
But something that you're going to do in that ed research are probably going to involve you doing something in the classroom anyways.
Right.
So I mm-hmm. think that thinking about how would you do this in the classroom could be the start of a research question.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So those things go together hand in hand quite often.
Because I have about 20 of those.
Well, the two Garfield articles that we all read had so many ideas for,
yeah.
you know, things we could build on, and then also just ideas for the classroom. I was jotting down stuff left and right, but I mean, there's just a ton of stuff we can build off of, which is really exciting. Also, I wanted to point out in the Lovett article, principle five was that idea of mental load, that learning becomes less efficient the more stuff you have to know, which I
yes.
think is such a drawback in teaching hypothesis testing, because you get to the end of the semester, and now you've got to teach them possibly the most complex thing, you know, in the whole course, that whole reasoning process.
I was thinking the same thing, Georgia.
Really?
I was, in fact, I teach a summer course, so I teach a 4-credit course in 5 weeks.
Ugh.
And we meet every day for 2 hours. And
wow.
it's intense. And what we decided is definitely in the summertime, we need to front load that course and leave that statistical, you know, the inference that we do teach at the end. We really need to leave more time because it just takes more time to process
mm-hmm.
that.
Yeah.
So I agree.
Aisha, what do you have?
Okay. So a couple of things. I had read the Garfield articles previously and really zoned in on the models that they talk about in terms of the different types of reasoning. I know for me, one of the big things that jumped out, and again, this goes back to what Jennifer was saying, was it's hard to separate, but I just kept thinking, you know, I'm in a class of 30. You know, I'm thinking of this as a potential action research type project, and I'm in a class of 30. How am I going to do this with 30 students? Or, you know, there's another article, or one of the principals, I think when it talked about the feedback, giving feedback to the students and so forth, it's still not clear in my mind what is the difference between statistical reasoning, statistical literacy, and statistical thinking. And I'm not even quite sure if it really is that clear in the literature. Also, again, based on, I think in the Garfield article, she also said that. I'm not at the point where I can break it down. It's kind of like I know intuitively what I want the students to do and know, but I can't specifically define what that would look like. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in terms of offering definitions, I really like the Garfield definition of statistical reasoning. And I think we had, from the previous sets of readings, there were also some really good definitions in there. But in terms of me having it clear in my mind, what statistical literacy looks like, or I'm not at that point just yet.
Well,
something, because I was kind of in the same, you know, trying to come up with, okay, if I'm looking at all three of them, what is the key thing to hold on to?
Right.
And I think something that they all have in common is that idea of going beyond just procedural knowledge, you know, being able to not only, my students are fine with the formulas, you know, they can do all the calculations, but they don't know what it means. You know, so they memorize the rule that rejects null hypothesis, you know, when you get this number. But when I say to them, well, what does that mean? They seem kind of confused. So I think both the, you know, or all three, the literacy, the reasoning, and the thinking, they're trying to get us to go beyond just procedural knowledge to more, okay, in the context that you're working in, what does that mean? That, that's kind of, it
yeah.
helped me not feel overwhelmed by, okay, how am I getting at all three in my teaching?
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
as far
obviously
as,
three different things.
Yeah. As far as, I've been kind of toying with the idea that Aisha brought up of you know, that how do students think about these things? And I was thinking of getting a small group, you know, individually and recording them talk through doing a problem so I can kind of get in their heads and
mm-hmm.
understand, like, what are you thinking? Because I talk to my papers all the time and I go, what were you thinking when you were writing this? So I'd love to just put them on camera and have them work through one problem or, you know, and talk it out so I can kind of get it. What are they thinking? So I can get a better sense of what are they not getting or what am I not teaching?
Mm-hmm. I have a question. So are we kind of going into, it sounds like we're not really focusing in on one specific area of, you know, an intro course or whatever else, because, you know, a lot of the articles talk about specifically variability and how students, what students know and don't know about variability and how they go through the different stages. But if we're dealing more with the general, it sounds like it's a more general, how do they think? How do they process? Is that what I'm hearing?
Won't that be a little... you know, and this is coming from someone who's not a trained researcher, that seems like it might be a little too broad, you know?
Yeah.
We really need to narrow it down to one particular topic and how they think about that particular topic or how they reason around it.
You guys have brought up a hypothesis testing once or twice here, too.
Yeah,
I think that's
true.
What you should zone in on. But the difficulty of the reasoning demands that seem to be there in a complex thing called hypothesis testing. Just to throw out that you guys have, you know, a couple of you have mentioned that today already.
That's something very interesting to me just because I find the process of it itself interesting to me. But I found that I spend, now when I teach that material, I spend a couple of days just talking about or working on activities. Well, I talk about it also, and then we do activities where I teach them the reasoning first, you know, in a non-mathematical way.
Right.
You know, so we don't even do math. We talk about, like, real-life choice-making and decisions and how, you know, the decision rule and how do you know and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know how effective that is, but I would love to see, you know, I'd love to be able to see if that was, in fact, an effective way of doing it.
Yeah.
And even as Nirazu was saying, that you sit back and listen to the students, and in whatever area that we teach, I think that's an excellent way to get in the minds. We were talking about a theme is how students unpack knowledge, and
yes.
there's no greater learning on our part, I think, than listening to just different groups as they unpack, you know, they look at three graphs and have to answer questions on them, and they're brainstorming as a group, and, boy, you go from one group to the next, and they all have different ideas.
You know, go ahead.
And that's kind of the research that I'm doing right now, but just looking at ways of facilitating getting to that information outside the context of, you know, hypothesis testing specifically or variability. And
mm-hmm.
I know, Nairatsu, you were at that, the pre-conference workshop where they talked about the model eliciting activities, the
MEA, right. uh-huh.
and so forth, where they were using it as a way of trying to get to, I don't know, just really, I guess, visualizing the steps that the students are going through to solve the different problems. I don't know.
Aisha, something I've been thinking about also is, you know, I've been doing some of reading on my own about people with high IQs, And generally, the population of professors, the professorship, tend to have higher IQs than the average population, right? So we're up in like a couple standard deviations above the mean in general. I mean, not, you know, always, but also people with high IQs tend to process information differently. So like if I sit down and I look at a math problem, I tend to grasp things very quickly, you know, and I grasp it intuitively, but the average student is not, and plus because their intellectual development, even not even including the influence of IQ, is, I mean, they're 20, right? So they're, you know, so the point being that it would be interesting to see how are they actually thinking, because we're coming, you know, we're not maybe having beginner's mind when we're teaching, you know, and we have to know what they're thinking, you know, we have to know how exactly they're trying to learn something like hypothesis testing, which would go back to unpacking information. Like,
right.
how does a 20-year-old, you know, of a certain level of intelligence unpack information, and how, you know, how do they do it so that we can teach it that the right way? Oops, sorry about that.
And also, I think that gets at misconceptions that students have, and you would never even think that they were could ever come up with that. Like, then you say, oh, that's what you're, no, that's wrong, you know.
Yeah.
Well, not just that's wrong, but
what I was going to say is that so yeah, it's wrong, but now why are they coming up with that?
Right,
exactly.
And I think one of you was going to say that too, but you know, that would be an interesting thing. That would be the answer to that question would probably be interesting.
Yeah.
Because it would speak to maybe something you could do in the classroom or in the course to try to deal with that.
This week, we were looking at, in one of my courses, you know, just the beginning, center, shape, spread, variability, measures of center, and I gave them, in small groups, an activity where they were looking at three histograms, and they did have frequency, and they had scales on them. One was skewed to the left, one was symmetric, one was pretty uniform, and they were asked questions, what is, you know, which mean would be higher, how would you relate the mean and the median, how about this, which has the greatest standard deviation, and then they had to match them up to box plots that were three parallel box plots. And it was amazing the information that I gathered from the students just listening to their conversations, and I was, when I said, you're wrong, I would not say that to a student. How are you looking at that, especially the heights of histograms, and this was also in the literature, and I could relate to this so much. When students look at a uniform distribution, they think that that has less variability, and absolutely, that's what my students thought. And
wow.
We talked about the heights of the bars, and that relates to frequency, and how far away from the mean are you, and it's just amazing the information you can get from the students on something like that, and what a teaching moment that can be for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, and that's kind of the issue that I talked about earlier when in the articles they talked about feedback. And, you know, with one of me and 30 of them, how do I do that? How do I create these teachable moments for, you know, in classes that large? So, I mean, it may have to be that we go, if we do this, that we consider Nairadze's idea about videotaping,
mm-hmm.
the student, you know, like talking to students one-on-one
mm-hmm.
kind of thing, because it's just been, as a classroom researcher, that has been my biggest struggle. I mean, even if I tape the students in the little section, in their groups, by the time I can't look at the video the same semester because of IRB, so the teachable moment is gone. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know. It may not be for the benefit of those particular students,
mm-hmm.
but maybe we can get some insight so for the next class you might do things differently, hoping, of course, that they have the same misconceptions.
That's what I try to do. But
Aisha, can I ask, I've got a question for you.
Yes.
Why can't you view the tape in the same semester?
That's what our IRB committee told us. We cannot view the tape in the same semester.
So if you That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you're teaching those students.
Yes.
And you're in the classroom with them, so they're doing if it's really in the classroom, they're doing a natural, normal thing in the classroom.
Right.
Why? You know, I'm just curious about that.
The reason why I had to go through IRB was because I wanted to videotape them.
Yeah.
Because there are 30 of them, and they're in groups of three. So I can't be everywhere at once. I'm videotaping simultaneously all the little groups. So I had to get IRB approval to videotape. And then it came back saying, if you videotape, you absolutely cannot watch it in the same semester. And I asked other people about it, and that's what our IRB board told. That's kind of what they're going with.
It'd be interesting to push that or to see what the arguments are, because I'm like, what are you doing? What would that cause you to do? You are the instructor in the classroom.
Right.
So you're grading their work. You're,
yeah.
You're forming impressions about them every time you're in the classroom. So why? What is it that would, you know, reviewing a videotape do? But every student should have a right to say, I don't want to be videotaped, or you can't use my image. I understand.
Right.
You know, when you're reporting. You know, when you're reporting, you can't show me or something like that, or I don't even want to videotape. But I think that's interesting. My understanding is if you could argue that that was part of the course, and that you actually used it for evaluation, then I think that they couldn't tell you that you can't look at it.
Okay. I'll talk to our, we have a center here for the teaching and learning. I'll talk to the director there and, you know, see if maybe he would back me up a little bit, because I did speak to him about it when it first came up, because I said, well, you know, I'm not necessarily going to publish this. I just kind of want to see what's going on, and it's hard for me to, I can't be everywhere at once.
You know? I guess I'm sorry for taking time here, but
yeah.
I'm thinking of courses in communications where they're developing people's ability to speak.
Right.
And they videotape and review them. It's part of the course.
Like normal.
Yeah.
I'll check on that. Thanks for the heads up, Bob.
Yeah.
Is an audio recording acceptable in lieu of a video or not?
No, it's the same.
Okay.
And then perhaps this conversation might actually help us, but the reason why I went with videotape versus audio, the first time I tried audio, I realized that I was missing a lot of information because I couldn't see what the students were doing.
When they were pulling their hair out, you couldn't see that.
Right, or if they were grimacing, or if they were, how confident they were. And I also couldn't see, so that's why I went with video as opposed to
lots of nonverbals.
Right.
I'm glad you mentioned IRB, because I was thinking that we all needed to, I don't know what the time frame is like at everybody's school, but we all, I need to check into mine because I've never done anything with IRB before. So it seems like if we're going to do something in, I'm assuming next fall?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Is that the timetable?
Well, you might actually, you know what Noratu was suggesting, that you actually interview some students.
Mm-hmm.
You could be doing that any time. We would love to see you do some stuff like that before this year is out. That might be part of your gathering information to kind of inform your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And you would need to look in to see, you know, it's kind of pilot study type stuff in a sense, but you'd probably have to look into IRB for that.
That's something, for me, I would have to do very quickly, because I don't teach. I only teach the intro course in the fall, so in the spring I would just be teaching the second course, just as an FYI. So I should check into that.
But Georgette, is the intro course offered in the spring?
Yes, it is.
And somebody else is teaching it?
Somebody else is teaching it, yeah.
So that's actually a better situation for IRB. You'd be more likely to get IRB approval because you're not the instructor.
Oh, okay.
And so you might be able to... you might be able to videotape class sessions, and then the instructor never sees the videotapes because they're not the researcher. You might be able to invite some of them into one-on-one, that's the other thing I was going to suggest, is not do a whole classroom, but maybe bring three or four students into a room and say, here's the problem I want you to work on, and now you don't have all the noise going on around. You just can focus on them.
Right.
Okay. So I guess what we would need to do pretty quickly is come up with what is the problem that we would want them to work on.
Right.
Like, what is the question that we would want them to address?
Well, one of the advantages, I've noticed a lot of studies on the mean and the standard deviation and spread, and that's early in the course, so rather than waiting till the end of the semester to do it. So maybe something that we do teach towards the beginning or the first half of the course, one of those topics might be a good one to select.
Okay.
But it is a suggestion,
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, just so we can have some sort of structure, so the four of us are not each doing something completely different, so we can
right.
kind of have some uniformity in what this is what we're asking, this is what the problem that the students are working on, whether
well,
we're recording them or interviewing them or, observing them work in a group or however we end up structuring it, so we can
okay.
have a common problem.
Well, can we kind of just for a second each just, as we just throw out the things that, when you're grading, you're like, why would they think that? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do you have that moment when you're grading and it's like, why would you
what
think
that? What moment?
You know what I mean? Maybe
I think
those thoughts.
Talk to
the
papers. I think that's what she said.
Better that I talk to the papers and not to the students. Well, for me, it's variance. Variability.
That's, I think there are a lot of studies on that, though, is there?
Yeah, and also just the idea of, hypothesis testing, because it's so weird to them
mm-hmm.
that you're testing the thing you're not interested in. that's how, they're like, why are you testing the null hypothesis? I'm more interested in this work. So it's hard for them to, when they get to the end, they can... save the hypothesis because they've kind of memorized that. But then when they get to the end, to say, okay, so what does that mean? Hard for them to go back and relate it to, okay, I'm rejecting the null hypothesis. What does that mean? I guess it's because, usually nobody, we don't like to be rejected. So it's kind of hard for them to see rejection as something that could be positive.
Mm-hmm.
So if they didn't get the result they wanted, they find it, they just have a hard time with going back to that and making sense of what am I saying exactly.
I would teach it so that they have to write it in English first.
I do, too. Yeah.
And then translate it into math. And I think that kind of helps them because they can kind of go back and just, maybe they don't always get it. Yeah.
Does that help them?
They get the right answer. I don't know that they get the logic, but they'll say,
right.
I'm rejecting the null, therefore the standards have not been violated for MPG for cars or something like that.
Well, I was just trying to play devil's advocate
right.
and say, do you know that really helps them, and what do you mean by that? Does that mean
yeah.
a higher percentage of the students reason correctly than if you don't do it that way? So this hypothesis, I'm just going to throw out a couple things right now, and one is, do you all mean the same thing by hypothesis testing? That's one. And two is, if you agree upon what it is, then what is it that people have to do mentally to carry out hypothesis testing or understand hypothesis testing or reason correctly about hypothesis testing problems? And then given that, what do you think the challenges are? And what are not just, what's not just one way to address it, but what are some promising ways to address that? Because that might lead to some interesting research of trying different approaches to promoting an understanding about reasoning in hypothesis testing. I'm just throwing those out there to kind of seed the ground.
Synthesizer, can you just kind of give me an overview of what just happened? Yeah, sorry. Just a quick overview.
To summarize what Bob just said, he would like us to look at, or he suggests that we take a look at, do we all mean the same thing by hypothesis testing?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a great question, because as Nirazu was saying that, I was thinking, well, do we think of inference as only hypothesis testing?
Right.
Are students okay with confidence intervals? And are they okay sometimes? No, yeah, there's a lot of issues there.
yeah.
The other thing that was brought up was what do students have to do to reason through a hypothesis test? What are some of the challenges?
Unpromising ways. Mm-hmm.
And what are some promising ways to address that?
Mm-hmm.
I think I got those all.
So why don't we all talk about that? I mean, why don't we each talk about what we understand hypothesis testing to be, and then we'll maybe move on to the next question. How does that sound?
Sure.
That sounds good.
Can I ask this of you guys? When you teach hypothesis testing, do you teach the confidence intervals first?
Yes.
Do you teach it the concept of hypothesis testing and confidence interval together with
mm-hmm.
proportions first and then go into the means? Or do you do a whole unit on confidence intervals and then say, okay, now we're going to go, you know, this is getting interval for the estimate of the population and then go into hypothesis testing where here there's a statement that's made, a claim, and we want to test it?
I see you started to talk. Do you want to answer that first?
I do confidence intervals and hypothesis testing together, and we do the means together and then the proportions together.
You do means first.
Mm-hmm. We do means first. So I do the basic confidence interval for means, hypothesis testing, you know, setting up hypotheses and so forth for means, and then the last thing in that unit before we move on to proportions is actually the link between using confidence intervals to do hypothesis tests.
Okay.
And then from there on out, we just give students the different, you know, say, well, the only, here are the only things that change. And we move on to proportions and two sample and so forth.
And when you teach the means, do you teach T and Z or only T?
In the lowest level course, we teach T and Z because we have to. Some departments just really don't want to let go of Z. But in my second level course, not a dick to business, Georgette, but in my second course, which is still an intro course, but just for students who had AP3 or something, we only do T.
Okay.
Yeah, and we start with hypothesis testing in that course.
Okay. Yeah, also.
I do, I kind of teach it under the umbrella of inferential statistics, and I tell them that we can make estimates, so we talk about estimates, confidence intervals, or we can have a theory that we're testing, then we talk about hypothesis testing. So I talk about them separately, but under the umbrella of learning something about the population based on the sample.
Okay.
And I'm trying to let go of Z, and I'm doing it slowly. I have them in the one class, I have them after they've been with somebody else and they've done the Z. So I don't want to tell them that you probably won't ever use the Z. I don't want to talk to them too much. So we kind of talk about when would you use the Z, and, you know, so what do they think in... Does that make sense that you would, you know, how likely is it that you would use the Z? And once they figure out that, well, you probably won't know, if you're trying to figure out the mean, you probably don't know the population standard deviation.
Right.
So very unlikely you'd be using the Z. Then they're more accepting of the T. And, of course, they like that the guy worked for Guinness.
You guys probably know that I have an MBA. I don't have a degree in statistics.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sort of fell into teaching statistics just by starting to tutor it and then lead study groups, and all of a sudden I'm teaching it. So I never felt really confident about straying far from the book until I went to the conference. So in the past, I've taught means first because that's the way it was in the textbook. My new textbook is proportion first, and I like that thinking better. So that's what I'm going to be doing this semester. I don't want to teach Z anymore because I feel like they have too much to learn already with hypothesis testing. And then generally the way I have been teaching it and the way the new textbook is as well is that we teach confidence intervals as a separate topic, and I don't teach hypothesis testing with confidence intervals.
I also do not have a degree in statistics. My degree is in math ed education. But over the last 15 years, I've been teaching AP statistics and then intro statistics at the community college level. And I'm comfortable with what I teach, but I always hesitate to say something. Incorrectly, so please correct me if I'm wrong, those of you that have a statistics degree, but I'm from the knowledge that I've gained over the last 15 years, I look at Z as going by the wayside because of what we're talking about, and the present book that we're using, which is the DeVoe, Vellum, and Bach book, only teaches the T for the means. The prior book that we used did teach the Z, but every time I taught the Z, I thought, boy, you know, you go through that whole section and they say, yeah, but you know what, you never use that. The reasoning behind it, you know, they're looking at the theory behind it, and I do think that that's valid, especially when I'm teaching in a math department. Some of my students might be math teachers. The mathematics behind it is solid, and, you know, I like the formula. I like to pick apart the formula and then go from there. So for me right now, I will teach T with means. And I think Georgette and I are using pretty much the same textbook. Hers is the business version of data stats and models. Well, I use data stats and models, but not that we can't stray from the book, but the first time through a book, one of the reasons we chose this book is we like the thinking of the authors. But
so we do
teach about the same way.
So do we agree? I mean, are we all teaching? Do we all mean the same thing with hypothesis testing? I mean, for me, it's you know, five or six steps or whatever. You know, make the hypotheses, come up with a decision rule, take a sample and get a test statistic and make a conclusion, and then put it into English. You know, that's how my understanding of it is. How do you understand the process itself to be?
I have my students always set it up in words as they're setting it up in symbols as well. I say this is the symbols, that's the statistical language, let's put it, like you said, in English. And when we get to the end and see that we reject, what did we reject, and let's put that into words.
Okay.
I kind of use I used to dream of being a lawyer, and I throw away that dream. But I kind of use the how the legal system works. I tell them that they're like the prosecutor. They're interested in showing that, you know, I teach nurses and I teach teachers. So, you know, I tell them that they're interested in showing that this treatment works. But they can't test that. So they presume that it doesn't, you know, like you presume that somebody's innocent. And that's how I help them kind of set up their hypothesis, and it helps them realize that when you reject a null hypothesis, you're saying you have sufficient evidence to say, yeah, the treatment works, but you haven't proved anything either way. You know, you just, which bothers them that you don't prove anything.
I know.
So they're like, but the numbers say, and I go, well, okay, so this is your conclusion, but there's also a chance it could be wrong, and they don't like that. So that's kind of how I try not to have them. I mean, there are steps that we go through, but I try not to have them focus on, okay, what's the second step? Okay, what's the third step? Because then they get so caught up on, if they have six instead of seven steps, then they freak out because I skipped something, even though they actually did everything they're supposed to do. So I try to just help them see that, okay, those are your hypotheses. Now gather the evidence. Based on that evidence, how likely is it that your null hypothesis is correct? So they can look at the p-value and talk about that.
Well, that's actually another good question. Do we all use p-value? think that that's the standard now. But
yeah,
yeah. Okay. I mean, we have to teach the test statistic too, but p-value, because this, it's in the software.
Right.
So I prefer p-value. Actually, I'm moving away from the test, computing an actual test statistic.
Does anyone use critical value?
That's
what I meant.
The rejection region, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I do both, but I'm trying to shift from looking at the critical value and just using the P, because that's what they see when they read journal articles. It's mostly
exactly.
The value that's reported.
If I may butt in, I think you'll see status in the world of statisticians. Critical values are never mentioned.
No.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about P-values and P-values not just for rejecting, but also kind of indicating the strength of the evidence against the null hypothesis. And another thought I have for you, you guys are having great conversations today. Not that you haven't in the past, but I think you're really getting into some interesting things here. That all of you, to a certain extent, though, seem to be talking about procedures. And
yeah.
So I'm just going to challenge you to. If even if a student can carry out all the procedure correctly, do you think that indicates that they have an understanding of hypothesis testing?
No.
So if you say no, then I'm going to challenge you again. I don't think you're going to get to it in the next 10 minutes necessarily, but maybe you will. But then what does it mean to understand hypothesis testing? Does it mean just to understand how to carry out these steps in the procedure, or what is it? And just one more thing. I'm very sorry.
Yeah.
And then George Cobb, he made some presentations at US COS that you may have maybe not seen, but he's got this wonderful article. I think it's in TISE, T-I-S-E is the online journal, Technology and Innovation in Statistics
uh-huh.
Education. And it's about the something about the Ptolemaic, like in Ptolemy, Ptolemaic revolution, and he's not just throwing Z out, he's throwing T out.
Oh.
He doesn't even do formal hypothesis testing, he does resampling.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have to buy into it, but I think it'd be a worthwhile article to find and read, because I think he really gets at the essence of the logic and reasoning behind inference and hypothesis testing. By getting away from the formal procedures.
Okay,
that would be interesting to study if we looked at.
If you're going to go in this direction.
Yeah, because we could look at even for us it would be different to change our thinking of how we taught the hypothesis testing.
Huh. Well, that's a good point that we also have about 10 minutes, if not less. So we need to start wrapping things up. I should we have 8 minutes. So I don't know if the phone just cuts off. So I think we need to like start thinking about our next call and also what we're going to read.
Well, I guess we should read that Cobb article, and it is volume 1, issue 1.
Very good. That's exactly where it is.
There was also an article that was in one of the, I can't remember which article, it was in the references, by Robert Hogg, Statisticians Gathered to Discuss Statistical Education, and they talked about issues in the classes, you know, what is wrong in the classes, and that what are some of the problems, and let's see, I think he talked about topics. That needed to be, topics that were important for our first course. That might be something that can help us. I don't know. That's just a suggestion I'm throwing out there of something that I happened to pick up.
Can I throw out an alternative suggestion? Or maybe it could be both. You know, we can do both. But I'm not sure if I know the answer to the questions that Bob has asked. And I would need to think about it. So I was wondering if it might make sense for us to really each sit and write out our own responses to the three main questions he had thrown out before.
Okay.
what is it that people have to do, and, you know, without really talking about a procedure. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Procedures. I just wonder if that, you know, if we can each brainstorm and come up with a list, then we can, next meeting, talk about where it overlaps and try to refine what we collectively mean by hypothesis testing. And that's
okay.
Just a suggestion.
That's a good suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys think?
Yeah, because Lauren got me thinking about that too. Like, you know, how do we know just because they can do the hypothesis testing? That
how do we know that it? Yeah.
You know, like, that they understand the logic behind it.
And I don't even know. Yeah, and
so
you know.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, what do we mean by that? What do they need to do to show that?
And it's not just for me, you know. And I have a PhD in statistics. Is do I know? Right? Because it's like you say hypothesis testing, and I automatically think, okay, we do X, we do Y, and this is what we come up with. But, you know, to just really sit down and write out what I mean or what I know about hypothesis testing and the logic.
And Aisha, I'm just going to tell you that Joan and Andy and I and other people that I've been, you know, having conversations with over the last 20 years in stats, we keep going, you know, we really don't know what we mean. And we've never talked this through.
Yeah.
And so some of what's happening is us discovering what this means, and then that gives us new insights. So you guys are in good company.
Do we want to maybe each try to find an article that I noticed that when I went to Joan's website and also on the CAUSE website, there are more articles on that website that so many suggestions for articles, and I don't know if between, you know, what Joan has listed as courses that, I believe it says, courses that every statistics educator should, or not courses, readings that every statistics educator should read, or something to that effect, but I don't know if we each want to try to find one article that goes along with this concept of hypothesis testing. Bob, is that kind of out there in those readings too? I don't even know.
Are you looking at the website right now? I'm going over to right under readings and publications. Is that what you meant? Important,
you know,
readings?
It's something that I was looking at last weekend, and I found a whole bunch of lists. There's research and professional development as the two items, and I think one of them, I don't know, something linked me into Joan Garfield's page, her own page, and it had a lot of readings there on her own page for, I think it's a course that she teaches. That might have been at CAUSE. That was probably at CAUSE. CAUSEweb.org. But my question to Bob is, are there articles out there that would discuss this, the concept, besides the George Cobb article?
Yeah, I'm trying to, I think I'm going to send you guys a PDF of a chapter that I wrote in a book, and just a little bit it was comparing mathematical thinking to statistical thinking, or mathematical reasoning to statistical reasoning. And it's a real short chapter, and in it, part of it I talk about how this logic of hypothesis testing is basically modus tonens in reasoning and logic, and how that's been shown to be very difficult for human beings to do.
Yeah,
and that's why I think that's one reason that it's difficult for students to understand, because it's just a form of logic that's difficult. So I'll send you that. There's a lot out there. There's this null hypothesis testing controversy, and you can find a lot about that, about NHST, null hypothesis something. I can't remember what the S is for, but that might be useful. But there's a lot of literature about this kind of double negative reasoning, like the type of reasoning we want to do. And it's not just in statistics. It's in the psychological reasoning literature.
Yeah.
But people have been studying this for 30-some years and trying to figure out why is it so difficult and why can people do it well in some situations, not in others. One of the findings I know is that if people do it well in a situation where they've practiced it, a lot,
right.
So that it's not an abstract form of thinking, it's a well-honed, almost procedural way of thinking, and then they do very well with it.
It's like a form of logic, and maybe that's something else we need to look at. formal, you know, formal logic like they teach in law school, kind of formal logic, you know. But we have 2 minutes, so how do we? What do we want to do? We're going to send each other our hypothesis testing, like say 2 weeks, maybe. And then
just send it to the brains, the synthesizer. They can put it all together.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm the synthesizer, so if you want to send things to me, but I was wondering if do we want to do that, or do we want to, is that what our discussion will be next time, is that we'll talk through those, or do we want
to
be writing?
Oh, we'll talk through it, okay. But we'll have it in, so we'll send it to you. Or you can put it on Blackboard, too, because we have the Blackboard. And then articles, we have a minute. We have a minute to talk articles. So there's the George Cobb.
It won't cut off Georgette.
Oh, good. Okay, so I'm freaking
okay,
out.
This is my experience, yeah.
Well, so maybe we should read the George Cobb one and also the chapter that
Bob is
sending
us. Yeah, I think that's
okay.
Cool. And the brainstorming.
And then trying to figure out what we think of, you know, how we understand it so we're on the same page.
But I think I agree. So are we sending, do we need to send our brainstorms to Jennifer or not?
What do you think?
I think we
can talk about it.
I think we can just talk about it. I don't know.
Okay.
I prefer to just talk about it. I think.
Okay.
I think we need to think about it and we need to write it down so that we can process it and just take the time to process it.
Okay.
But,
okay.
Bob,
I'm looking at an article called "The Introductory Statistics Course of Ptolemaic Curriculum." Is that what you're talking about?
That's it.
Yeah.
That's the George Cobb one.
Okay.
That's it.
I found it.
If you want to send out that link to everybody, because it's just a PDF you can download online.
Also,
Jennifer was talking about a page to go get a list of readings. So I think it's when you go to causeweb.org and you click on the research link that's on the left-hand side, underneath that you'll see readings and publications.
Mm-hmm.
You click on that link, and it takes you to a table of contents, and the first one is important readings.
Yeah.
And that's a list that we put together a while back of this is that thing that we think every stat ed researcher should have read these things. And there's I think you can get to every single article online. Yep.
Okay.
So I don't know if you still want to go with Jennifer's suggestion that you maybe look through that and see if there's something you want to pick out.
Okay. So maybe we should each pick out an article to summarize, perhaps, in addition to the two that we're reading.
Yeah, so we'll definitely read those two and then find something else on the list.
Okay.
And you want us to read that or bring it to the group, and then we could all read it for the next one after. I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe we can pick two, read one. I mean, I think we should come to the next meeting with some suggestions for further reading, but I definitely think we should each read another article and do the summary again.
I know for me personally, if I'm going to do the brainstorm about, you know, hypothesis testing and what it means and so forth, excuse me, a lot of my time is going to be spent researching that specifically and seeing what is out there. I'm not sure.
I think we do have a tall order for next time as far as...
Okay, then maybe we don't need to do an extra article.
To do it well, I think that brainstorming the Cobb article, what Bob's going to send us...
I take a look. Mm-hmm.
And then I will... And then maybe bring a reading... as a suggested reading for
I'm the overcommitter, so I need people to rein me back. So knock yourselves out.
I was just writing to Joan today that I'm already overcommitted, so I don't want any more.
So whose role is what next for the next call?
Okay, Aisha is the organizer.
Hold on, okay.
I'm the moderator. Georgette, you're the synthesizer, and Jennifer is the recorder.
Yep. Okay, anything else?
Wait, I didn't hear the last part, sorry. I guess I can figure it out.
Jennifer's the recorder.
Uh-huh.
Georgette, you're the synthesizer, right?
Uh-huh, that's right.
Okay, got it.
Okay.
When is the next meeting?
The next meeting. We need to pick a date, don't we? Oh, my gosh. All right.
October. Now, Narazu was not going to be available at this time anymore. Is that correct?
That's right, because my classes start next week. So
okay.
It, I have a class that goes from 9:30 to 10:50, which is, I don't know what time. I can't do math in my head.
2 o'clock.
Right. I tell my students that all the time. So that's how many hours? She'll be done at
1:50. So it'll be 2 here.
It'll be 2?
Can we do like 3 to 4?
So we could do at 2 o'clock. For your time, if that works.
Does that work for you, Narasso?
Yeah, that'll 11. Work for me.
It would be right at 11. Okay, 2. And then on the 30th or what?
30th?
Yeah, I can't do the previous 2 Fridays.
The 30th?
The first Friday or the last Friday, yeah.
Because I could do the 23rd, but I have family in town, and I'd prefer...
I can't
do
the 23rd at all.
Oh, good. Okay.
30th?
Oh, it's the 30th at 2 p.m.?
Uh-huh.
In 2 p.m., yeah.
All right.
And then I won't be able to join you on that one.
Oh.
I'll be at a meeting. I'll be finishing up a meeting in D.C. and then hopping on a plane. So it'll be Andy's turn.
Okay.
If you're right.
And we're talking 2 p.m. Eastern. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
2 p.m. Eastern. Okay, so 1 p.m. here in Minnesota.
Bob, thank you for organizing our thoughts for us today.
Yeah,
I think
well,
that really helped a lot.
Thank you for letting me intrude, and that's good feedback. You guys do just a great job, so I don't want to say you have to think a certain way or whatever, but I'm trying to help you synthesize, I think, when I'm doing these things mostly.
Okay, great.
So,
excellent. Okay. Well, thank you all.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye. Okay, bye-bye.
See you next time.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for setting up Blackboard for us.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, I'll set it up so that we have to call week by week, so we'll have all
okay.
our documents on there. So.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.